The caricature of a patient on a couch telling all to a cool, detached psychoanalyst with a German accent is all too familiar to us in movies and TV shows and single-panel cartoons. That image is part of the legacy of the still controversial founder of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud. According to today's experts, what did Freud get right and where did he go astray? We'll find out from Richard Keller, professor of medical history and bioethics and associate dean of the International Division at the UW-Madison. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as the old blessing or curse goes, may you live in interesting times, and Sigmund Freud certainly did. Interesting times, interesting place. What psychologically, in terms of the study of psychology, was his background?
So Freud is born in Moravia, which is in the contemporary Czech Republic, in 1856. He then moves to Austria when he's about 3 years old with his family. He went to medical school, and he had a pretty successful career in medical school, if a rather uninteresting one to some extent. He pursued basically a research-based career track in biological neurology. And so he actually enters the field as what you might consider today something like a cognitive neuroscientist. He then takes a pretty dramatic turn away from neurology and into what we would probably call a kind of psychodynamic psychotherapy after he spends about a year in Paris working with Jean-Martin Charcot at the Salpêtrière Hospital. And this is a radical change in his career.
Was there any kind of a tradition of psychotherapy at this point?
Well, this is where he really has his eyes opened when he goes to Paris. Charcot is also a neurologist, but he's treating primarily young women who are afflicted or who are diagnosed with hysteria. And what he does is he has these Tuesday and Friday sessions at the hospital. The Tuesday sessions are for physicians. The Friday sessions are for the public, where he brings in women that he's evidently never seen before and diagnoses them on stage and demonstrates his capacity to induce hysterical fugues in the patients. What Freud takes from this is a sense that basically, psychological states can be induced psychologically, that there doesn't necessarily need to be a lesion on the brain or anything physically wrong with the patient, but that one can induce a different psychological state simply by speaking to the patient, by acting on the patient from the outside.
Can you give me a case study there as to exactly what sort of state Freud was able to induce and how he did it?
Freud himself wasn't able to do this at this point, and I think arguably he never is. But what Charcot would do is he would basically, through hypnosis and through other kinds of actions, he was able to put a patient, you know, take a patient from an apparently normal condition and put them into a hysterical fugue. That is a kind of departure from reality, where they would demonstrate symptoms that were clearly psychogenic in origin, that had no physical pathogenesis, but were simply induced by the brain.
Did he do that by recreating the experience that would have triggered this response?
Charcot doesn't do that, but what happens is Freud basically takes a few lessons from his experience with Charcot, and the most important of those is that, indeed, these kinds of states can be influenced by the experience of the patient. And that's where Freud takes a radical departure from Charcot, where he begins to basically connect patients' psychological conditions, or their psychical conditions, as he would probably argue. He begins to recognize that these can be very closely linked to experiences that the patient has had, experiences the patient typically can't remember, he would argue, but that are basically resurfacing as repressed memories and expressing themselves in physical manifestations in the patient.
Was hypnosis necessary to identify these repressed memories?
Early on, it is. So the first psychoanalytic patient is a woman. Her name is Bertha Pappenheim. She was a German Jewish woman in the late 19th century. She comes down in the psychoanalytic literature as Anna O. Basically, they took her initials BP, went back one letter, A-O, and then called her Anna O.
Really wanted to make sure she was anonymous.
Exactly. So she is actually a patient of a colleague of Freud. She's not even Freud's patient. She's a patient of Josef Breuer, who's a German, also neurologist and psychiatrist, who is medically trained. And he works very closely with Freud. They work through correspondence, and their letters are really a remarkable resource for historians. Anna O is a fascinating patient. She had nursed her father through a terrible illness that leads to the father's death. And she's clearly traumatized by her father's death. And she's expressing that trauma in a number of physical symptoms. For example, she's completely unable to drink water, even in the sweltering heat of summer, for about 6 weeks at one point. She actually survives by eating fruit. That's the only way she hydrates. Another symptom is that she has paralysis of her limbs, and sometimes she loses her voice. She suffers from aphasia, an inability to speak. None of these things can be connected to any physiological symptoms at all.
And they're very clear issues, too.
Very clear issues. So what happens is Breuer hypnotizes Anna O. And when he hypnotizes her, she will occasionally mention things. She'll go into detail about experiences that she's had that she can't seem to recall when she's not in a state of hypnosis. And as it turns out, once she relates these stories, the symptoms seem to be at least a little bit alleviated. They seem to improve somewhat.
In the telling of them.
In the telling of them, exactly. And even when she comes out of hypnosis, she's able to function, at least according to Freud and Breuer, relatively successfully. So, for example, what Freud connects the inability to drink water to is an experience she relates while under hypnosis that she had had a house guest, an English woman, and she walks into the English woman's room and the woman was allowing a dog to drink from a glass of water. And she's disgusted by this. She's really traumatized by it, I guess. And this probably connects to the fact that she's nursing her father at the time. And so all sorts of things that might seem relatively trivial have an additional psychological weight to them. She recounts this story under hypnosis, and then she drinks a full glass of water upon coming out of the hypnotic state. And she's fine. Evidently, the symptom just goes away once she's been able to confront it and recognize that it's not really that big a deal.
But she's confronting it under hypnosis. How about when she comes out of hypnosis, how do the two tie together?
Basically, Anna and Breuer discuss what happened under hypnosis, and then she's able basically to cope with the relative triviality of the memory. Now, that's one case. There's another case that's a little bit more extreme that Freud and Breuer consider to be the origins of her paralysis. So there's a moment when she's tending to her father at his bedside. She has her arm draped over the back of the chair, and she falls asleep. And then she has kind of a waking dream as she's coming out of sleep that there's a snake crawling toward her father's bed. And this is a hallucination or a waking dream. Everybody agrees that this didn't really happen. But she tries to swat the snake away, and her arm has fallen asleep. So her arm is paralyzed in this moment.
She's
powerless to save her father, exactly. And so Freud, again, traces her symptom of psychogenically induced paralysis to this moment, right? And indeed, probably a much more traumatic moment than the dog drinking the glass of water. And this one takes a little while longer to go away, but it's something around which they engage in the analytic sessions afterward. And so Anna O comes out of this referring to talking about her symptoms and seeing a gradual alleviation of her symptoms. She describes this as her talking cure.
By talking, is just talking through her problem with her psychoanalysts and getting it out.
That's exactly right.
However, of course, she was a very convenient case, I suppose, because her symptoms were so clear and also things that she was willing to talk about.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. What we see is really a dramatic departure in the case of Anna Oh, and she appears in the 1892 Studies in Hysteria, where Freud and Breuer collaborate to basically devise what's eventually going to become a psychoanalytic practice. What happens is Freud argues very clearly that physicians had been engaging with hysteria. They had been trying to treat hysteria for quite some time. But they viewed it as primarily a problem of young women, and they viewed it as something with a most likely a physiological origin, something to do with a woman's anatomy.
Yeah, the very word hysteria comes from the Greek hysterion, meaning the womb, and the theory was, at least in classical times, that the womb was trying to get out of the woman, and that was the root of the hysteria, or at least the analogy.
Exactly. And that changes a bit, of course, over time, but it's still connected very closely with the woman's anatomy and what physicians at the time argued was a particular psychological organization that has a great deal to do with a woman's anatomical difference.
So is there no such thing in their scheme as male hysteria? What's the difference?
Not yet, right. So there is a sense that men, in particular middle-class men, upper-middle-class men, can suffer from what they call nervous weakness or neurasthenia. And this they understand as basically a sort of condition of over-civilization, that as men move away from physical labor and begin to work in offices, that there's a sort of inherent masculinity or inherent expression of masculine physicality that basically, men just don't have an outlet for this anymore. And so they begin to suffer from a kind of nervous weakness as a consequence. But nobody calls it male hysteria until the First World War.
And by which time we would probably call it more like PTSD.
We would call it that now. During the First World War, it's referred to alternately as either male hysteria or shell shock for the most part. But we rename shell shock, PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder really around the time of the Vietnam War.
Yes, much later. As the 1890s progress, Freud is already making a name for himself. He's in the center of Europe where all these cases, of course, are available to him, as well as the ability to make the cases known. And so at what point does he become the leader in this whole sense of psychoanalysis?
Sure. He begins publishing pretty widely, beginning around the middle of the 1890s. And he's, you know, really, he's in a remarkable context. I think we can't look at a figure like Freud and the development of psychoanalysis outside of the really particular context of Vienna in the 1890s. This is a moment where really most people would understand the turn of the century as a period, the turn of the 20th century, as a period that really embodies remarkable progress across really much of Europe. You're witnessing the Second Industrial Revolution, which leads to a wave of new consumer products that really improve life fairly dramatically for most Europeans. Fairly widespread electricity, communications get better, rail networks begin connecting people and shrinking distances and expanding time in ways that really hadn't happened really much prior to the turn of the 20th century. But for all of this apparent progress, there are many who see the world as getting not better, but indeed worse.
In part because of this inability to express one's earlier roles, whether you're a man or a woman?
To some extent, indeed. I mean, what we're seeing at this point is the rise of radical suffrage movements for women, the rise of an increasingly radical working class politics, increasingly anarchist tendencies,
yes,
and increasingly violent strains of communism in particular. So many people see this kind of radicalism not as marking progress, but indeed as tearing down an old world order. And so what we see is the rise of a kind of populist, largely anti-Semitic, very anti-feminist politics on a sort of populist right that turns away from a sort of rational assessment of the world around us, right? A rational assessment that says, gosh, things are actually probably getting better for most people, and turns toward experience and this feeling of a kind of loss of privilege. And what we see is a real turn toward demagoguery, We see the rise of a radical right-wing mayor named Karl Luger in Vienna, who embraces a really radical anti-Semitic and populist tone. It's really something that one can hardly imagine.
One can hardly imagine.
Indeed. And so this is the context in which psychoanalysis emerges, this turn, again, away from the rational world and toward the world of experience. And it's a realm in which Freudianism really resonates. Not that he's winning many fans among the populist radical right at all, but it's an extraordinary moment. If we think about the kind of art and culture scene in Vienna at the turn of the 20th century, where figures like Gustav Klimt, the painter,
his name keeps coming up in more contexts.
Indeed, indeed. And so, if you look at Klimt's paintings, he paints these really extraordinary canvases where much of the action is actually going on the interior of the figure. And so there's a turn away from the exterior and toward the interior. You can see the same thing in the kind of passionate and sometimes often morose, really melancholy music of someone like Gustav Mahler.
Oh, yes.
For example, who's actually a very close friend of Freud's. They take daily walks on the Danube.
Yes, they had some very interesting conversations.
Absolutely.
Freud did a little psychoanalysis of Mahler, as a matter of fact, at one point.
Indeed. And so this is really the context that witnesses Freud's rise. He begins to cultivate a following among a number of different psychiatrists and psychologists.
There must have been a lot of missteps, though. Not even Freud necessarily, but adherents who misapplied the principles.
Absolutely. And there also, of course, is a pretty strong reaction against psychoanalysis, even among other psychologists who are thinking in terms of a kind of psychodynamic psychotherapy. So someone like Pierre Janet in France, for example, looks at Freud and basically sees a kind of perversion with the emphasis on sexuality, with the emphasis on childhood sexuality in particular. This is pretty upsetting stuff. And so the response to psychoanalysis is not certainly universal acceptance by any stretch of the imagination.
We're going to look further, a good deal further, in fact, at the career of Sigmund Freud and the progress of psychoanalysis when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Richard Keller, and we're looking at Sigmund Freud and the development of psychoanalysis and all of its various ramifications. This cauldron that you mentioned, Richard, of all these things going on in Central Europe, Vienna, we'll say, is the hub at this point, politically, artistically, we haven't talked about Darwin. How did that affect this thinking and psychoanalysis?
Sure. There are many who would argue that, really they're sort of Marx, Darwin, and Freud as the real sort of principal thinkers of the 19th and early 20th centuries. I'll take Marx off the table at the moment, but just to look a little bit more closely at the relationship between Darwin and Freud. Freud would actually present that critical trio of really radical thinkers as probably Copernicus from a much earlier period.
I think he wrote an essay, didn't he?
At least a paragraph.
Copernicus, Darwin, and Freud
himself. So what Freud argues is that, if Copernicus tells us that we're not at the center of the solar system, and then Darwin tells us that we're not even really anything but animals. What Freud tells us in his own assessment, right, is that he demonstrates that the ego is no longer master in its own house. So he certainly positions himself as really a radical thinker and someone who can really shift our perceptions of our place in the universe. What's the relationship to Darwin? When Freud's in medical school and when he's in his early career as a neuroscientist, he's reading Darwin like crazy, and he comes completely under Darwin's spell. And how this winds up expressing itself in his work is that eventually psychoanalysis will present itself as a kind of developmental model. That is, that it's something that's very close, that's certainly a part of child development. And we look at the child's physical development, the development, for example, of gross and then eventually fine motor skills, education, right, the entry into language, all of these things that are part of normal child development. Freud will see a process of psychical development as well, as the psyche forms throughout childhood, eventually in adolescence, and then we enter, if everything goes right, a kind of healthy adulthood. And so he posits this as really a developmental model in a kind of Darwinian sense, where it's not so much about natural selection, but it's about whether development goes normally or not, and that all sorts of things can go haywire in the process, which can really reflect, they can manifest physically in the patient as these kinds of symptoms.
As long as you've mentioned the ego.
Sure.
Now, what about those other two characters, a superego and the id that Freud developed?
Sure. This is actually a relatively late development for Freud. It's into the early 20th century when he begins thinking about these different sorts of components of the unconscious, and that is the ego, the id, and the superego. He begins with the relationship between the ego and the id, that the ego is basically the psychological self that we present to the outside world. The id is all of the crazy things that we really want to do, right? All of the sorts of things that we simply can't do in a civilized society. Whether it's, usually he organizes this around the erotic life, but we can think about this just in terms of all kinds of manifestations of things that we really want
to
do. Whether it's, responding violently to someone who cuts us off in traffic and shouting at them, which we shouldn't really do in a civilized world. Whether it has to do with sexual expression, which we have to sort of keep under wraps and find an outlet for it in very circumscribed ways, whether it's simply eating cake for breakfast, right? There are all kinds of things that we really want to do.
Throwing an apple in the lunchroom.
right. All sorts of things that we really want to do that we find we can't do. And so that's really the id trying to come out. That's a kind of a crude representation of it, but that's, the basic idea. The superego is a much later addition to this trio, what now becomes a trio of components of the unconscious. The superego is basically that which constitutes the principal mechanism of repression, that which keeps the id under wraps and which punishes the ego in the process.
Punishes the ego?
Effectively.
What, through guilt or what?
Through not just guilt, but really through repression. One of the things we have to recognize is that this is all happening at an unconscious level. So we often think that we might actively repress memories, but we don't, at least according to Freud, right? What Freud argues is that this is all an unconscious process. That's why we can't remember any of it.
Right.
So when we have a terribly traumatic experience, we don't remember a bit of it. Right, it's a sort of blackout period. And that's because this action of repression is so powerful and indeed happens at an unconscious level. So Freud offers the metaphor of, say you've got somebody disruptive in your classroom and you escort that person out of the room and you shut the door. But that person doesn't cease to be a disruption because that student starts pounding on the door to be let back in. Mm-hmm. And that's what he argues is sort of happening. If you can imagine this happening at a completely unconscious level, all of that which is repressed begins to pound on the door trying to be let back in. And that's where you see this kind of punishment of the ego.
Does that result then in, we'll throw another big term on the table here, neurosis?
Indeed, it can result in what we would – or what somebody like Freud would call neurosis. So one of the things that's important to see in Freud is that he's actually – he's practicing with a very specific kind of patient. He's practicing with largely upper middle class patients, most of them Jewish, most of them women or adolescent women to be a little more particular. And he's treating them not for disorders like schizophrenia or anything that we would call a kind of psychosis. He's treating patients who are certainly suffering from miserable mental illnesses. But they're suffering by and large from depression. They're suffering from what's called in the period hysteria. They're suffering from diseases that are really, or disorders, I should say, that are on the neurotic side of the spectrum rather than the psychotic side of the spectrum.
By neurotic, we mean a behavior that blocks need fulfillment?
Essentially, right, right. And so these are patients with sort of nervous disorders that aren't necessarily harmful to those around them. Mm-hmm. Certainly, patients suffering from really extreme depressive neurosis can be a severe danger to themselves. But they're not dangerous to the world around them. They may pull off their behavior in public, but they have to constantly go back to their house to check that they've turned off the gas jet about 1,000 times.
Right, compulsive obsessive.
These kinds of obsessive compulsive disorders, that sort of thing. So things that might prevent the patient from living a fully normal life, even though the patient might appear relatively normal on the outside, right? If you think about a Woody Allen movie and all the kind of neurotic behavior there,
yes.
These are relatively well-off people who live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Right?
So. Well, speaking of Woody Allen, you mentioned aphasia. Does that include stuttering, which is a kind of seems to be a major component of a lot of Woody Allen characters?
Sure.
What does Freud have to say about this inability to, complete a sentence or even get the words out cleanly?
Sure. Well, this is something that really comes out in the treatment of soldiers during the First World War. So one of the major symptoms of shell shock, in particular for the officer class, was stammering or stuttering. This is something that one often saw in upper middle class British men who had been through the public school system and had suffered the really, I'll use the term repressive, but not in a Freudian sense, experience of British public schools and the real mm-hmm. kind of cruelty in those schools.
Very disciplined and, as you say, often cruel discipline.
Right, right. Whereas enlisted soldiers, NCOs, would tend to experience not stammering but mutism,
really?
A complete aphasia, a complete inability to speak. So not necessarily Freud, but those who had read a great deal of Freud, people like William Rivers, who is a psychiatrist who's read quite a bit of psychoanalysis and works at the Craig Lockhart Hospital in Scotland treating British soldiers who've returned from the front for shell shock. Begins to develop a theory that the complete aphasia of working-class soldiers, of enlisted soldiers or conscripts, has to do with their inability to have any say in their experience at the front, that they have to simply sit there and take orders, mm-hmm. and any, sort of talking back to officers will result in extreme punishment.
So they were trained for silence.
Trained for silence, and that begins to express itself as a pathological symptom after they experience a major trauma at the front. The officer corps, of course, comes from a very different social class, typically, and a very different set of experiences, and have different experiences at the front. And this is about the stammering is about their relative powerlessness for speech to turn into action.
Maybe they were a better trained to, in terms of their education, to speak and to express themselves verbally.
To some extent, right. They know that their voices are valued, right? They mm-hmm. they are invested in as members, fully invested members of society, fully vested, I should say, members of society and full citizens. At the same time, they're completely unprepared for what they see at the front. Everyone goes into the First World War thinking that they're going to be riding on horseback, brandishing swords, vanquishing the enemy. For 3 months, exactly. And, of course, they wind up burying themselves in the ground in order to live, entering this kind of troglodyte world where, you're seeing your best friends blown to smithereens next to you while you're trapped in a trench waiting to be bombed, essentially, completely immobilized. So hysterical paralysis is another symptom that often comes out in shell shock, so where soldiers are unable to walk. And again, people like Rivers attribute this to that kind of immobility in the trenches expressing itself in the body after a traumatic shock.
So Freud actually did analyze these soldiers. They would have been presumably Austrian soldiers.
Freud does treat some soldiers. Mostly what happens is the experience of male soldiers during the First World War leads to a much broader acceptance of psychoanalysis in the interwar period. So where Freud runs into lots and lots of resistance Europe-wide to the very idea of psychoanalysis, the very idea of repression, the very idea of a psychogenic kind of hysteria, when soldiers began manifesting these symptoms by the thousands, and when I won't say psychoanalysis, but a psychoanalytically informed treatment of those soldiers brings decent results and actually brings these men back to psychological health, what we see is a much wider acceptance of psychoanalysis after that period.
I would have to guess that part of his or anyone's treatment would have to do with having those soldiers who had had the experience share it with other soldiers who had had the experience because, I mean, without actually having been in that situation, nobody could fully grasp what they had gone through.
To some extent, and you see that at these military hospitals during the war where soldiers will share their experiences to some extent with each other. What they don't do is share those experiences with the public.
Right.
This mental breakdown under conditions of the stress of war continues to be something really stigmatized and shameful. Many physicians, I say that this leads to a fairly widespread acceptance of psychoanalysis. There are still many who completely reject it, many physicians, many psychiatrists who completely reject it. And they see that kind of breakdown as a kind of weakness or malingering, as an effort of these soldiers to get away from the front.
Cowardice,
exactly.
So Freud, by the time we get into the 1920s, that very complicated period between the two wars becomes internationally known and comes up with what new concepts then? It seems as if he's always developing new concepts.
Sure. In 1919, he begins to elaborate. He's talked a great deal about sex already and a great deal about how our sexual impulses, and of course they're linked to some extent to this Darwinian notion of reproduction as essential for the survival of the species, right? But also very much it's about sexual pleasure and a sort of guilt at experiencing sexual pleasure that feeds this repressive mechanism. He now begins to look at violence after the First World War. He begins to see us as having not just an eros drive, an erotic drive, but also what he calls thanatos, or a death drive. And he looks at this kind of almost compulsion, this sort of compulsive violence of European society during the First World War as evidence, as a sort of manifestation, a collective society-wide manifestation of that death drive, of that kind of impulse toward violence.
Does he link it at all with the problems associated with a very dense population?
Not so much. He certainly begins one of the things that he does in the interwar period is he begins writing less and less about individual patients and more about society as a whole. So he makes a turn toward I hesitate to call it social psychology because anybody in our psychology department who calls him or herself a social psychologist would consider themselves completely removed from this. But he begins to diagnose, let's say, widespread psychical components of European society.
After taking a broad sample, he probably would come to some conclusions. I mean, he's analyzed enough patients, right, by now that he sees patterns?
To some extent. Mostly, I think he's just riffing on the sorts of things that he sees happening Europe-wide.
Oh, uh-huh. And extending that. Mm-hmm.
And extending his theory of a universal unconscious that he considers to be part of every human, right, wherever one is, and begins to try to extrapolate from what happens at the individual level to try to see these kinds of tendencies across all of European society.
A universal subconscious?
I would say a universal unconscious.
Uh-huh.
Freud's very careful about not really using the term subconscious, but rather unconscious. And the way that I try to ask my students to think about this is, you know, a subconscious almost seems like something that would be just trailing along, right along, you know, just beneath consciousness.
Yes.
The unconscious, Freud will tell us, is basically like that which is not consciousness, okay? That which is the opposite of consciousness. So the unconscious is almost like 7-Up used to brand itself as the uncool, completely apples and oranges away from the conscious. So that's one of the reasons he's so careful about this. But Freud begins really as early, even in the pre-war era, to basically need to find the unconscious as a universal component of all people. Wherever you are, if you are an Aboriginal Australian, if you're a European parliamentarian, no matter what, you still have an unconscious. And so it's that universality of the unconscious that allows him to extrapolate the kinds of things that he sees in this very small segment of society that he's seeing in his patient, in his practice, and to extrapolate from that and apply it to the world as a whole.
What are the commonalities of the unconscious among these widespread populations?
Well, what he argues is that as children, we all go through this process of the development of the unconscious, that we are born and we don't have a distinct self, a distinct body even, mm-hmm. from the body of our mother.
Right.
So we are born at both a psychical and a physical level, we are what he calls the oceanic self, right? Just kind of flowing in and out of others.
Mm-hmm.
And we cannot exist separately from our mothers, essentially, right? What happens is gradually with that sort of separation is felt over time. And this is a very painful process. You can think of it almost as a sort of psychical weaning from
sure.
the mother and the establishment of an individual self.
Right.
And that's a wrenching process, right? And it's often experienced through this Oedipal triangle that he develops, where there's a sort of relationship between the mother and the father and the child. And this is often in pop culture, we think of this in a very sexual way, right?
Right.
That, I think our popular understanding of the Oedipus complex is that the typical example is that the son wants to sleep with the mother and the father gets in the way, and so the son wants to kill the father. And this is, of course, sort of what happens in the Oedipus story.
Sort of, although he didn't know it was his father when
really.
He killed
doesn't
him.
Know it's his father, doesn't know it's his mother. And so, it's a pretty tortured metaphor. But what Freud really is talking about is how the child has an exclusive loving relationship with the mother, okay? Not necessarily a sexualized one. And it's really when that relationship gets sexualized that we often see a kind of pathological development. So let's just talk about how this works normally for the normal process of human development. Basically, the child has this exclusive loving relationship with the mother. The father comes in and says, okay, it's time to grow up, right? And doesn't necessarily physically separate the child from the mother, but comes between the child and the mother. The mother will have date night, essentially, if we want to put this in contemporary terms. And so the child's, basically forcibly, through physical distance, separated from the mother. And this is a rough transition for kids. Right. This is a rough transition where very often a child would begin to resent the father for coming between the child and the mother. And that's, again, a very normal process. And we eventually reconcile that. We come to terms with it and we recognize that we are individual selves. And we go through this process and we're just fine at the other end. Right. Not saying that adolescence isn't traumatic for all of us in some way, shape or form. But we come through this and we're basically just fine. There can be moments that Freud documents in many of his patients where this doesn't go according to plan, for example, in the case of the Wolfman, a young Russian aristocrat, Freud assumes that this child was about a year and a half old and witnessed his parents in the act, and that utterly traumatizes him forever.
He was how old, a year and a half?
About a year and a half old.
Mm-hmm.
Again, according to this really elaborate narrative that Freud develops that is full of holes wherever you look at it, but it does make the theory make sense.
Year and a half sounds awfully young, but yeah, okay.
Indeed, especially to leave such an impression.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other – that's another hour of conversation if we want to talk about that story.
Good.
In any event, it's when this goes wrong and typically when this Oedipal resolution goes wrong through a kind of sexual trauma, whether it's the child being abused by one of the parents or abused by another relative, for example, or whether it's something the child sees, whether it's something the child even imagines, this can make that whole process just force it right off track. And that's when this process of repression begins, because the child who sees his parents in the act at 18 months or 2.5 or 4 years old doesn't know what's going on, and according to Freud, might interpret this as an act of violence. And this is something that that the child has a very hard time dealing with, and that unconscious mechanism of repression simply forces that away. Later, and very often the child is asymptomatic for quite some time, again, according to Freud. Once that child goes through puberty, then that unconscious memory begins to knock on the door. It begins to make itself known in all kinds of ways.
Have meaning.
It begins to have meaning. Again, not to the patient's conscious reflection, but it begins to express itself in neurotic development.
So we'll talk about neurosis and sex and Freud some more when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Richard Keller, and we're talking about Sigmund Freud and the development of psychoanalysis. And what we haven't talked about yet is dream analysis.
Sure. So at the turn of the century, I think the original publication date is 1899, but it's often called 1900, Freud publishes The Interpretation of Dreams. This is a radical step for him. It's this incredibly long book. It's 500 or 600 pages long. And it basically is the moment when Freud makes a couple of really critical steps. One of the first things he does is he begins to argue that dreams offer a window into the unconscious. They offer a window into our repressed desires. They offer a window into what it is we really most want. Because they offer a glimpse of the irrational world of the unconscious.
Well, I was going to say they also offer us a window onto what we most fear.
Absolutely, absolutely. But paradoxically, Freud would argue that even the worst nightmares often have an element of desire to them.
Hmm.
So he traces different kinds of dreams. He explores different kinds of dreams in the interpretation of dreams. So he looks, for example, at children's dreams. He looks at a sort of typical, irrational, healthy adult's dream, and then he looks at nightmares, as well as the dreams of his patients. So he, for example, one of the kind of canonical dreams is his own daughter, Anna Freud's dream of the wild strawberries. So basically, he hears her talking in her sleep, where she's saying, strawberries, I want wild strawberries. And saying it, and she's 3 years old at the time, something like that, and muttering in her sleep. And basically, this was a kind of wish fulfillment. She says that she's ravenously hungry when she wakes up, that she wants to eat strawberries. She had eaten strawberries to the point of getting sick the day before. This is a very clear case of complicated wish fulfillment, but expressed in a pretty simple way in a child's dream. He then writes about one of his own dreams, which he calls – he gives titles to his dreams. So this one is called The Museum of Human Excrement, where he has this dream that he basically goes to the bathroom, he's urinating, and the toilet itself is covered with excrement. And he begins, while he's urinating, to wash off the toilet of all of this filth. And this is an ambivalent dream, he would argue. It's got very disgusting content. It doesn't seem to express a desire there. But indeed, it does demonstrate his mastery over it, right? Because as he's able, through the act of urination, to clean all of this mess. And so he begins to think about Hercules cleaning the stables.
Oh, sure.
He begins to think about now the power of the analyst to conquer this human filth in which he's been waiting.
It makes perfect sense to me, Richard.
It seems to, right? It puts a kind of a weird dream in a heroic light. But then the question is, what do we do about the nightmare? If dreams are about the fulfillment of unconscious wishes, what do we say about nightmares? What kind of wish could they possibly fulfill? And here he talks about this dream, a truly horrifying dream that any parent reads, and it, you know, it's incredibly poignant and incredibly moving, of the burning child. And this is a dream that's clearly a nightmare that's based in some real circumstances. The person who relates the dream had a child who had died of a fever, and the body is laid out and surrounded by candles, and the parent is sitting in a kind of vigil next to the child. And the parent awakes as one of the candles has fallen over and puts out the fire. But what happens is the parent has a dream that the child's body is on fire because of the candle. Presumably that's sort of one of those semi-waking dreams. And the parent sees the child say, "Father, can't you help me? I'm burning." And so it's, again, you know, I almost tear up thinking about it, how difficult that must have been for the parent to experience with a child who had just died. But Freud argues that this is a kind of wish fulfillment, because what happens is in the dream, the child is alive. The child speaks.
Oh, there's still an opportunity to save the child.
Still an opportunity to save the child, exactly.
From the fever, so, that's the burning is the fever.
Exactly. And so this is this absolutely horrifying dream that's a nightmare by any stretch of the imagination, but at the same time, of course, does express that desire of the parent to see the child alive again and to possibly save the child.
Would these dreams be recurring dreams in order to have this kind of validity?
Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're one-off dreams. I think the wild strawberries. I think any of these dreams is just a one-off. Indeed, many of his patients do suffer from recurring dreams, and that's where he begins to see the validity of dream analysis as having some kind of a window into these unconscious processes.
When Freud started getting into increasingly writing about sexuality, and particularly child sexuality, did a lot of his cohorts, colleagues, part ways with him?
Not necessarily. Jung never really gets on board with child sexuality in quite the same way as Freud. And that's, again, a whole other conversation that I don't think we have time for today. This is where he begins to lose not necessarily his followers so much as he loses the general public. This is controversial stuff. And one of the ways in which he begins to grapple with that is through what historians have called the quote-unquote abandonment of the seduction theory. So to summarize this really quickly, initially Freud is convinced that most of his patients had experienced some kind of a sexual assault or some kind of sexual abuse when they were children. And that's why the neurosis is expressed very often around sexuality. Sometimes, again, this could be something as innocent as walking in on one's parents in the act. But sometimes it's actually something much more serious than that, an actual sexual assault. This is enormously controversial, right? Because if you have a daughter who's experiencing neurotic symptoms, are you really going to take your daughter to go see an analyst who's then going to turn around and blame you for having assaulted her?
Yeah, that's got to be
having abused her sexually.
A serious problem.
And what Freud comes up with, and some would argue that this is a cop-out, this is when he stops believing the patient, I think that's a kind of an uncharitable view of what happens. He begins to argue, even in the late 1890s, that it's possible that the patient could have imagined the assault.
Oh, a false memory.
A false memory, right. And that false memory still has all of the weight of real memory.
How do you sort the one out from the other?
That's something that he argues he doesn't need to do, because really, whether it's false or not, the patient's still experiencing these kinds of symptoms. And so what he tries to get at is what, to some extent, really happened, not to the extent that he's going to prosecute one of the parents or go to the police and inform them about this habitual abuse of the child, but really to try to alleviate the patient's symptoms. And sometimes he does bring it back to an assault or something that very likely was an assault. Sometimes he brings it back to the patient's imagination and a kind of false memory. So, and this is, I think, a really important turn and something that one of the ways in which I think Freud still resonates in contemporary psychology. For all of psychologists' efforts to distance themselves from Freud at the present, to say Freud was really wrong about just about everything, where I think they're on pretty solid ground to some extent. Certainly, you know, one of the things that psychologists have demonstrated is that memories can be very easily falsified, right? It's very easy to trick the memory. And this is something to which Freud at least opens the door, right, and gets people thinking about. And so, you know, certainly somebody else would have come up with it in the course of the 20th century. I wouldn't say that but for Freud we're talking about false memories. But I think Freud certainly opens the door to that, and his legacy can be felt in a number of other ways as well.
Speaking of his legacy, though, where do modern contemporary psychoanalysts or psychiatrists or psychologists think Freud got it wrong?
Probably the notion – really, virtually all of it, right? The
really,
notion that dreams offer significant insight into the unconscious, the notion that there is such a thing as an unconscious itself. So really, the whole kit and caboodle is something that carries, again, very little weight in contemporary mainstream psychology. Indeed, Freud's probably much more influential – at least the idea of the unconscious and the theory of psychoanalysis is much more accepted in philosophy or in literary criticism at the moment. But one of the things we can't deny is that Freud's an enormously important historical figure. You mentioned in the introduction, you know, where would The New Yorker be without psychoanalysis?
I was thinking
cartoons?
Of The New Yorker, actually.
but beyond being a really timeless cultural reference, we can see a number of ways, I think, beyond the idea of a false or malleable memory, in which Freud opens the door to looking at human psychology in important ways. I don't think we'd be in the same place with something like PTSD had it not been for Freud and for psychoanalysis. Again, psychiatrists and psychoanalysis would disagree about the process of the ways in which a traumatic experience expresses itself in physical and psychological symptoms. I don't think they would agree with Freud about the how of it. But we don't really deny the fact of it, right, that these traumatizing experiences, whether it's an experience of sexual assault or whether it's an experience a hostile front in wartime, you know, these are traumatizing experiences, and they can make themselves manifest in physical and mental illness. I think the notion of a talking cure, the idea that it can help to talk to someone about your problems, this is also something that psychoanalysis really introduces and really makes prevalent. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a psychiatrist who believes in psychoanalysis right now, but I think you'd also be hard-pressed to find someone who thinks that we should just purely medically manage the symptoms of mental illness. Clearly, the best outcomes come from very often a combination of medical management of mental illness as well as psychotherapy, as well as conversations. And then finally, I think one of the most powerful legacies of Freud is the normalization of mental illness. One of the things that Freud tells us is that, you know, psychoanalysis, the goal behind psychoanalysis is to convert the patient from a condition of hysterical misery into a condition of ordinary unhappiness. what he's basically saying is that we're all a little bit crazy. We're all a little bit neurotic. That this
all
is a fundamental condition of living in civilization. And I think that goes a fairly long way to reduce some of the stigma of at least milder forms of mental illness from which we all might suffer.
Well, suffering or not, it's been a fascinating hour, a very illuminating hour, having to do with Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis and its legacy. So thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks so much for the invitation.
Richard Keller is professor of medical history and bioethics and the Associate Dean in the International Division at the UW-Madison. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.